Welcome to Endeavors.
Kick it, boys. Hello, and welcome to Endeavors, broadcasting to you from wherever you are, wherever you may be going, or wherever you may have been. We have a fantastic show lined up for you today from the renowned Vancouver Bach Choir, which is celebrating its 85th anniversary this year. I speak with local choir member and sometimes actress Winnie Noel. She talks to us about her long history and love of choral singing and the tradition that's entwined in Bach and Handel and a lot of the classical chamber pieces that we hear at this time of year, such as Hallelujah. You'll also hear from guitarist David Sinclair, who is performing with A Very Noise Christmas. He'll talk to us about that. And as well, you'll hear from great Vancouver band Data Plan, whose new album is The Madness Hides. And that's Data Plan, D-A-D-A. We're going to start with the title track off their album. This is Data Plan with the...
Breathe in and imagine that you're there. And now in present time, feel the emptiness in your heart. The desperate longing to feel once again that special connection.
Reward yourself by checking your emails. No new messages. The importance of health and attention to details. The fall was effortless. More than ourselves, it's our tension.
Thank you.
that was the Madness Hides by the Data Plan, and I'll be speaking with lead vocalist Malcolm Biddle a little later on in the show, but right now I am pleased to be joined on the phone by a longtime member of the Vancouver Bach Choir, Winnie Noel. Winnie, hello.
Thank you. Welcome to you.
So the Vancouver Bach Choir is a bit of a tradition here in Vancouver. Do you remember what first got you involved with the choir and with singing?
Well, I got very involved with singing when I was a little girl because my parents both sang in a big choral society in my hometown in England. And then I joined the school choir, and then I joined a youth choir. And when I came to Vancouver, I waited a while, and then I joined the Christchurch Cathedral Choir. And one day a friend of mine said, "You must join the Bach Choir, Winnie, you'd love it." And I was beginning to find it was rather, I had young children, it was a bit hard for me to attend Thursday night rehearsals at the cathedral, Sundays, you know, all the services and everything. So I actually left that choir and came to the Vancouver Bach Choir, and I've never looked back. I just love it. So that was in 1980.
You mentioned your background singing in England, and England especially has just a very strong chamber choir choral tradition, you know, from school age right on through.
That's right.
What have you noticed, you know, how would you say you were able to translate that, your background growing up in England, to when you came here in Canada and started singing over here?
Well, I, as a little girl, I had to attend all the concerts because there was no babysitter for me. And I just heard my parents and then both of my sisters for a while singing in the local choral society. And in England, you might be quite a small town, but the small town I lived in, Stafford, attracted a brilliant conductor. And so afterwards, the singers came to my house, and they had a reception for the visiting soloists. And so I just grew up in this wonderful atmosphere of listening to every concert my parents sang, and then meeting some of these very, very important singers who were traveling around England at the time singing. So it was funny, when I first came over here, I didn't join a choir. I waited a while because I was raising a family. So then I got interested again.
And Bach in particular, and in that era of musicians, seems to lend itself really well to the choral music and sort of the choral style of arrangements. What do you enjoy most about the music of Bach?
Well, we actually we don't do a tremendous Bach, but this season, a tremendous amount all the time, but this season includes Bach's Matthew Passion, which was one of the most important works and most glorious works he ever wrote. And we're doing that in the spring, in March. And so that is, and his music isn't easy to sing all the time. So that's a big challenge for us, and we're so looking forward to singing it because it's a big piece and it isn't performed that much because it's big and it's kind of difficult too. And we sing with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, and that's what the choir enjoys, is singing with the big orchestras some of the time, and then we sing with smaller groups other times, like the Christmas concert coming up. And of course, Handel's Messiah is part of our repertoire this year before Christmas, and so that's a very famous piece of work too.
I mean, that could be the most iconic piece of chamber music ever written.
Yes.
What is it like to sing a piece so well known? Does it put more pressure on the group because everyone knows it?
Well, actually, I think it's because it's so beautifully written that it never fades. I mean, we just, every time we do it, we don't say, oh, here we go again. I think we all realize that also that every conductor brings something special to it. And, of course, in this production of The Messiah, you may know that one of the young singers from our family of choirs, Simone Osborne, is the international singer who's taking the soprano lead in the presentation of The Messiah. So it's very close to home for us, and so it's especially exciting this time. And the music never fails to we have a lot of passion for it, I think, and it comes out every time we do it.
You also alluded there, of course, to your Christmas concert, which is on Sunday.
That's right.
Christmas is also the Christmas concert is also a long tradition with the VBC. What is it about I guess Christmas and the holiday season that lends itself well to the tradition of chamber singing?
Well, I think everybody can be that particular concert this weekend is actually something that the audience are also participating in, and a lot of the audience are quite new because they've got young children who may have just joined the choir that year, so they not only see their little family members singing and enjoying it, but then they realize that it goes right through all the choirs throughout the afternoon, and they all join in the carols, and then it gets to the adult choir in the end singing. And I think they get a sort of an oh wow feeling. Is this what it's all about? I don't think we ever get tired of this. This is one of our favorite concerts, actually. Because we see these young singers in front of us on the stage. You know, we're up at the back, and all the younger singers are on the stage at some time altogether, and then they go back down into a section of the audience while they're not singing. And it's absolutely, the choir love it. It's a bit of a zoo, you know, to get all ready.
we've been talking a lot about tradition,
yeah.
You know, whether it's the type of music or just the style.
Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, Bach and Handel and the chamber choir, why is it important to maintain such strict standards when it comes to that particular tradition?
You know, I think some of these traditions, particularly the Messiah, every, you know, is sung. There's now two choirs that do it alternately during the season. The chamber choir do a version with a smaller choir. They're a professional choir, and we sing it with the symphony. And I think part of the tradition is some of the words seem to strike home for us. There's the Alleluia chorus, of course. Everybody knows that, and everybody wants to sing it. But, you know, if you listen to some of the words of the other pieces, like If God Be For Us, Who Can Be Against Us, Thanks Be to God, and it's internationally. It's not just a Christian piece. It has a message for the world. I mean, why do the nations so furiously rage together? I mean, you know, that's a big question of our times. And I think it speaks to us. It keeps speaking to us if we think of it in other ways than, oh, here comes the Messiah again. You know, here we're singing Handel's Messiah for the umpteenth time. I don't get that feeling from any of the choir. We all just love it.
You know, you mentioned the lyrics of that song, and I think just given that the day and age that we're living in, some people, rightly or wrongly, could be turned off by a lot of the religious themes that are present in chamber music, whether it's Handel or Bach or you know, Beethoven, composers of that ilk. Even though the songs themselves may not be strictly, you know, written for, you know, strictly about religion, how do you make that accessible to all people?
Well, I think we've usually tried to fill the house, and of course there's a sort of a traditional audience that love choral music. But I think also people are the Messiah particularly is full of hope. And there are other oratorios that are full of hope, like Mendelssohn's Elijah is taking people from the wilderness and talks about worshipping false gods. And so I think a lot of it speaks to us in a way that the media doesn't. I think it's always very hopeful that we can live with each other despite the differences in our worship styles, you know, and our religions. And I never get the tension around it. I never get the feeling that what you were saying, we love it so much we don't think of it that way. So that's an interesting way to look at it. But I don't hear that conversation around the choir at all. You know, I think everybody just sings because we love it and we bring this music and we keep it going. So many traditions are changing, you know, in the world, and I think this is a very strong tradition of choral music that we want to maintain. And in the end, I think it keeps us together rather than divides us.
Now, I know you're also a local theater actor, and theater is something close to my heart, and I'm curious as to how you think your singing with the Bach choir helped you win one of your acting roles.
Well, it depends. What I don't do as much theater anymore, but I was. What turned me around was that I was in a play a year and a half ago called Rebel Women, which was all about the suffragette movement. And it was absolutely a riveting play. And it was by an amateur group, and it never got the publicity it needed. And now the film is out about the suffragette movement, called Suffragette. And I find, I'm a bit of a clown, in fact, in some ways, because I think the choir members know that at the last night of the proms, I've always been known for my kind of outrageous outfit. So there's a bit of the actor in me as well as the singer. At school, particularly, you know, I was in a big play about Robin Hood, and I was Robin Hood. And I think the choir sort of think, oh, there goes Winnie again. What is she going to do at the last night of the proms this year? You know?
So
I think there's a connection, and I don't do enough theatre. I would love to do more, but you really, actually, I don't want to do theatre that stops my participation in the choir.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about doing panto?
I've never been in a panto. And actually, yeah, I haven't been in. There was one at Metro Theatre for years.
Yes, and there's a great company out in Surrey called the Royal Canadian Theatre Company,
yes.
And who I've worked with in the past, and they do the only true British panto in the Lower Mainland.
Oh gosh, there used to be a panto at Metro Theatre, and I mean I've never been in panto. When I was a little girl, it was the big treat of the year to go every year to the pantomime. But it's a long way for me to travel to Surrey. You know, there's lots of rehearsals. We have to remember that the show goes on for so many nights, like 14 nights, but you've probably spent 27, so many weeks preparing for it, you know? So I've never done it. It sort of appeals to me. I don't know what part would I like, you know?
Do you find that, like, when you're performing on the stage, do you have a different approach maybe when you're singing versus when you're just straight acting?
Oh yeah, I think it is different actually, because you're one of a great chorus on stage, so you know, you don't want to stand out. You're part of the choir, so there are no theatrics sort of on stage. I mean, I think you can be animated, and I think your eyes can, you know, widen when you're singing something really wonderful. But I don't think it's. I think that sort of almost not totally different, but I think they're very different. For instance, if you're doing a little bit of film work, apparently you have to be much more still than if you're acting. And when you're on stage, I think it's like you're being more still than if you're actually in front of an audience and you're acting. Yeah, because you don't want somebody in the choir sort of tossing their head around or, you know, trying to look dramatic. I mean, you're part of a group, and you sing as a group in the choir, and you're aware of all the people around you.
So would you say that you enjoy being one of many or part of a group rather than front and center?
Oh, I love being part of the group. I love being part of this choir. It's the highlight of my highlight of my life, actually. And I don't like missing Tuesday night rehearsals. When I was in a play, I did miss a few rehearsals, and it was I don't like doing that because I feel we sing as a group. And if you have people missing, it doesn't seem quite right, you know. Of course, people get sick, and people travel. But I feel it's very important to be there for the singing, you know. So sometimes if I take on a role, if I were to take on another play, I'm getting up there, you know. I'm not sure how many are going to be offered to me. So I think I'm looking at a short-term event, if it happens, you know.
Yeah. You know, so I know for me, sometimes when I'm down, I like to listen to a nice, good piece of music in whatever genre. How can music heal us, or how music soothe us in perhaps ways other things can't?
Well, I think that has actually been very interesting because many, many years ago, there was a big change in the psych ward at, say, St. Paul's Hospital, where I heard that they had stopped, they had sort of rap music and stuff like that, and the patients got more agitated, and so they switched the programming of the music to more classical and folk music, and it made a huge difference to people in the ward. And so I believe that somehow the rough, sort of the heavy duty metal and rock and stuff, it hasn't taken over, because I think there's something about the kind of music the choir sings, the kind of music that the symphony plays, all the other groups that play music. They do experimental music. There's a lot of new music in Vancouver, a lot of new music organizations, and then there's the early music organizations, and then the choirs. And I think it's kept. We have really good attendances still, and I think it speaks of people wanting for a few moments to realize there's beauty in the world, even though the news at the moment and, you know, for a while has not been good. And I think people seek it out in many ways. And when they get to a concert, some people come for the first time and they go away and they say, "Wow, I didn't know I'd enjoy." We've got new people coming sometimes to our concerts, friends that haven't been before, and they just phone the next day and say it was very moving for them. I think the world needs this kind of music.
Well, the Christmas with Bach Choir goes up Sunday at 2 p.m.
Yes.
And then Handel's Messiah is December the 12th at 8 p.m. It's the 85th anniversary this year of the Vancouver Bach Choir.
That's right, yes.
Winnie Noel, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for asking me, and I hope I answered some of your questions.
Yes, for sure, and I hope to catch you at one of the shows.
And I hope you come to one of the shows.
Yes, I will do my best, for sure.
Good. Thank you, Dan.
Ciao. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was Winnie Noel of the Vancouver Bach Choir, and this is Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, cjsf.ca. Before we get to our interview with Malcolm Biddle, I was asked to do a giveaway. So in January 5th and 6th, there is a great dance spectacle coming to Vancouver at the Queen Elizabeth called Opera Warriors, an epic tale of power, passion, and the Peking Opera. And it's the same creative team that did the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony. It's a display of China's top creative talent which mixes contemporary dance, acrobatics, and martial arts into one extravagant show that will leave audience speechless. It stars three masterful Peking opera actors who are sidetracked on their journey to success by a fateful incident spurred by love and fear. It is the story of the superhuman feats of 40 masterful dancers to the move of more than 200 luxurious costumes of chiffon, silk, and embroidery worn in various scenes, and the colossal stage, which requires the first seven rows of QE2 removed to accommodate its 3,444 square foot capacity. We're having a contest. We are offering a pair of tickets for one lucky winner to attend opening night on January 5th at 8 p.m. at the Queen Elizabeth Theater. If you are interested in that, you can phone here in the next until 1 o'clock or at 778-782-CGSF. That's 778-782-2573. Or you can email me at endeavorsradio@gmail.com. And we will have the winner selected in the next couple of weeks. Okay, we have another song by Data Plan. This one features Johnny DeCourcy on piano. This is Helpless.
Three, four. Sick. One, two, three, four.
Once again, that was Helpless by Data Plan. Well, my next guest is the lead vocalist of a very interesting band. Part folk, part analog experimental, and part performance art project, the data plan has taken pseudo-technophobia to a whole new level. Their new album, The Madness Hides, seems to be a commentary on the digital world that we live in and the way in which we choose to live our lives, often not communicating face-to-face. Data Plan hopes to change that, at least through art. I had a chance to speak with Malcolm Biddle last week.
Hey, Dan, how's it going?
Good, man. How you doing?
Doing great.
So I got to check out a couple of tracks from the latest LP, Madness Hides. I'm very intrigued by this, and I particularly enjoy the videos just because they're so different from what we're used to seeing. What are you trying to say with the type of music that you make?
Well, good question. I mean, it's not really something specific. I guess it's like in some ways, you know, like it, obviously, in terms of the title of the band and the imagery, there's sort of a commentary on, you know, like. Modern communications technology and stuff like that, but it's really just sort of the idea is in calling it data is actually the idea. It's just to sort of make it absurd, and so we try to take these sort of like modern things that sort of like consume people's lives and just turn them into absurdity, so that, you know, I think people can just go, oh yeah, like this, you know, thing I'm obsessed with is just kind of like part of it, just another insane part of our, you know, human trajectory. You know,
would you say that you're subverting society itself in a way?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily plan on, you know, reverting back to like caves and things like that. So, but I, you know, I think like it's more about subverting like the way we communicate, and I just think it's nice to have as far as just making art, it's nice to have a direction in your, you know, your philosophy, and I just think it's a cool direction to just say, like, in terms of the way we communicate, let's keep it like face to face, or at least like not keep it, but just remember that that is real life, you know, is what actually we do with our hands and say with our mouths, you know, to another person.
Well, one of my biggest pet peeves whenever I go to a show is the enormous amount of videotaping I see on cell phones, or people watching their show on cell phones. As an artist, what do you make of that strange phenomenon?
Yeah, I think it is a strange phenomenon. I mean, like, you know, you try not to be like really bothered by it, and also, you know, people can do whatever they want. They're there, they paid, you know what I mean, they're usually friends doing it. But yeah, I think it's strange, because I just can't imagine, like, you know, like the quality of the video that they're actually getting, or, you know, like, it feels like it's more the act of filming than actually like filming to document something and actually like watch that video. And so it does feel like people just miss the actual, like, event, and then also never look back on the video that they made as well, you know? So it just feels absurd, you know?
And it seems to me from watching a couple of your music videos that you not necessarily advocate a sort of simpler way of life, but that we can get by without a lot of the stuff that we're currently living with. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, like, in a lot of cases, it's also just it is art. It is my personal writing, and so a lot of the times it's just like a reminder to myself, or at least, you know, myself and the people around me, like, you know, I don't think that I have an ideal, like, lifestyle. I think a lot of the time I'm saying to myself, like, remember that this is, like, you know, that the real enjoyment comes from these actual, like, natural ways of living and stuff like that, you know, and so, like, these luxuries and are just that, you know, so it's, you know, I try not to come off too much like, you know, follow me, because really it's just, you know, I find myself doing the same thing, so I just have to, that's why I write about it, you know.
So you try not to be too serious about your art in terms of maybe affecting your audience in a profound way. Rather, you just want to be like, look, this is what I do, come check it out type of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do think the subject is serious, but I mean, I guess I just don't think that I have the answers necessarily. So it's just a balance of, like, you know, like, this is what I think, but, like, I only think it, and, you know, I'm not, like, an expert, I'm just a singer, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I mean to tell other people, but I also mean to tell them with a grain of salt, because I'm also telling myself at the same time, and I'm just as sort of guilty of doing all these things as anyone else is, but yeah, I mean, it is important to me, and I do think it, and it does affect me, you know, I think that, like you say, when you're at shows and everyone's just filming it, like, those things do kind of drive me nuts, you know, and I think that we're sort of missing the point and heading in a weird direction when we do that stuff, but it's not supposed to be, you know, a guide on how to live necessarily.
Given sort of the subject matter, quote unquote, of what the band sings about, how would you describe your writing process when you go in to write a song?
Well, it's changed over the last little while. Changes all the time, but I mean, for the most part, for our first couple of records, Odetta Plan is Free and the Madness Hides, really, like, the music, I still sort of think of it as folk music, even though it's, you know, I guess it's sort of an unconventional version of it, but to me, it's part of the idea and the philosophy is that, you know, it is really just, part of the philosophy is just that, you know, you can be modern in a sense without, you know, like, doing these distracting things. And so to me, it's just that, you know, if you keep making folk music, it could potentially sound like this in 2015. So with that said, I pretty much write the songs like they're folk songs, you know, on an acoustic guitar or an electric guitar and get a melody. And I mean, I do a lot of just note taking, like, while I'm traveling or just cruising around, so I kind of pull from that, and I spend a lot of time, like, I'm really interested in a lot of it is sort of a mathematical game of wordplay, like, you know, I grew up in Vancouver in, you know, sort of like, I was in high school in the late 90s and stuff, and so a lot of it is actually sort of comes from hip-hop in terms of, like, just, I love the sort of math game of you know, putting syllables and words and rhymes together, and, you know, sometimes I find that even will unlock something profound, like in searching for something that rhymes with another thing that has X amount of syllables or something, I'll just sort of be, like, you know, blindly searching for a word, but come up with something, like, find this word that I never would have just thought of automatically, and then realize, oh, that's so, like, you know, that actually is so profound, like, I can fit that in, and now this is where, maybe, like, this is how the song was meant to be, actually, you know, like, if that makes sense.
It's interesting that, you know, because I was sort of in middle school, high school, around the same time where rap music was at its peak, and sort of you know, cheesy 90s pop music was dying out, and it seems to be now with music we're back in a revival of, you know, independently produced music, a lot of it, you know, hearkening back to a lot of the old styles of the 70s and 80s. And where do you think, you know, the music has gone in the last 15 or 20 years, you know, compared to when you were a kid? And do you like where it's headed?
Well, I definitely think there's great artists out right now, and I think that there's as great artists as there ever were in terms of, like, there's good writers and great musicians, obviously, and the production is great. But I think that the way that we access it, like, I'm not a sort of, like, you know, like, I don't really necessarily have a stance on, like, streaming services or anything like that, but I do think that in terms of appreciating music, it becomes a little bit harder to find things, like, really special and you know, actually get the same sort of, like, sentimental, like, memories from it and things like that. And it's just hard to even judge, like, what's out there, sort of, because, you know, you really, like, everything's on an equal sort of playing field, and so, like, that's great. It's totally cool, but it's really hard, you know, to look back and think of, like, these things that were so, felt so big at the time, and I mean, they probably still do for teenagers and stuff, but I sort of doubt they feel quite as big if you're just sort of streaming this single on Pitchfork or something like that. I feel like, you know, it's kind of different, but, I mean, I think young kids still have pop stars to look up to, but it must be interesting as a teenager to sort of, like, navigate what you really find, like, to like, speak to you, but, you know, also potentially only listen to that song once, or, you know, just stream it and never really, like, own it, or, gone and bought it. So, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't really answer the question in terms of the music, but I think the music is this, I guess the answer is, I think the music is probably the same, or there's, you know, like, people pushing the boundaries, but they really still have to swim in the same sea as everything, and so it's hard to really get a grasp on, like, what matters right now, you know?
Yeah, and in terms of accessibility, I know with The Madness Hides, at least I read that you, at least predominantly, released it on vinyl, and I'm curious as to why you made that decision.
Yeah, well, I mean, we recorded the record ourselves on, an old 8-track, like, quarter-inch 8-track machine, and we have it in our rehearsal space. So we kind of just wanted to do something that was really simple and just sounded the way the band sounds live. So we recorded on this tape machine, and it just sort of felt like it was a pretty, like, humble process. I mean, we were really, really, really stoked about it, but we sort of thought, like, I don't know, I just, for the same reason, I guess, was thinking, like, you know, I mean, the goal here isn't really to, like, take over whatever it is you could take over. The goal is for, like, the people who would listen to us to have another album to listen to and enjoy it. And I mean, like, I don't know if it was definitely the right thing to do, but we just sort of thought, like, it would be cool if people couldn't stream this, you know what I mean? Like, you had to buy it, and it was special, you know? Like, yeah, not everyone in the world is going to listen to it, but the people that do will sort of, like, they'll all own it, you know? And that's kind of interesting. Like, they'll be listening to it. You can only listen to it at your home if you own it. And so it sort of feels special. But I don't think that's what everyone should do, and I don't even know if that's what we would do again. But the fact that we were able to just record it ourselves and, like, in our own space, and we put it out ourselves, just meant that, like, we could do that kind of angle with it, you know? And we also we kind of homemade everything, so really right. Never went through, like, a digital phase. We went straight from the tapes to the vinyl plant, and our friend Johnny DeCourcy screen printed the covers of the vinyl, and you know, we did, like, rubber stamps and stuff. And basically, when we launched the record at the Western Front, we still had the records unassembled, so as people would come and come to the merch table, we would assemble the record there and kind of, like, hand number it and put, like, a rubber stamp on it. So it just felt like a cool thing to do, and it was a limited release, like a limited run, so yeah, it was just, like, a fun, weird project. But I think like the message of it not being streamed was important, but it also just tied into the fact that it was like a just like a limited edition special kind of craft style run or something like that, you know, where I think that's a cool angle now where, again, like everything's in a sea, and it's like if you can sort of just be like, here's one individual thing that kind of lives in its own world, then it can be special, you know, at least to your like small fan base.
You mentioned Johnny DeCourcy, and I know he features on the song Helpless. What was it like having somebody like him involved in your album process?
It's great. He's one of my best friends, and he's an incredible musician, and he's just got an insane energy. We made his latest record, The Master Manipulator, in the same space. So he's definitely like just sort of part of the crew, and but it's great because he definitely brings like just spontaneous energy. Like he's down to do I don't know. We have sort of all sorts of like ideas and just to do interesting things. Like for that piano part, there's a bar in front of our jam space, and so we actually had to the piano is in the bar, so we had to run like a mic from our jam space to the bar, and then have like a FaceTime, like Skype thing going in each space, and kind of like count him in on that, and then he just kind of played like in the right key piano stuff, and then we sort of like recorded it on tape, but we made like a tape loop and actually just sort of like triggered it on time, like and overdubbed it on a second tape. So it's just like we just, you know, he loves like us to just do experimental stuff, even if it's not you know, in the experimental genre. We're just trying to have fun with recording, and especially analog recording stuff. I mean, like our space is all analog, and that's just something that is just fun for our band and the other people who record in our space. And it's just fun to see how far you can go, because we've all been in bands and like are, you know, still work in digital recording areas, but it's really fun to sort of just see how close you can get to some of the things that are sort of just a given now in digital recording with tape, and just, you know, totally screw it up sometimes or actually achieve it, you know?
Yeah.
He's a freak.
I'm reading some of the headlines here, and it says Data Plan is secretly weird. That's from the Georgia Strait, or Data Plan are holding up a camera phone to society. What do you make of sort of this reputation that you seem to have conjured within the media?
Yeah, well, I think it's great. I mean, I'd rather be have the band have a message, and you know, like I like to embrace it. I think that. Again, like there's so many bands, like whether they're insanely talented or not, or whether they're leading the way or following, like it's hard to just sort of like make people realize like why you're special. So the fact that people are like catching that and actually like embracing it is great, because you know, we do like, you know, we do want to communicate that message, and so if people are if people are like willing to follow us and like write that about us, and it is good, you know. I mean, I don't want to be like, we still are just people that like to make music, but I think, you know, if the media matters at all, then it may as well have something to write about, you know.
Yeah. Would you say you have a favorite track off of The Madness Hides?
I really like the title track, but I also I love The Horns Below, which is the second track. Johnny also played guitar on the intro of that, and my brother is a sax player, and he plays saxophone in the band, and he also, by the way, makes all our videos. And Yeah, he's got a big... He kind of... we recorded that record actually around this time last year, like at the Christmas holidays, and he was living in Montreal, and he came back for the holidays, and we kind of had the skeletons of all the songs, and he... we played him that one, and I kind of just said, yeah, so, like, right here, there's a big, like, long saxophone solo, and so... You want to do that now, you know? And he just jumped into it, and kind of like it was just like a first take saxophone solo over this progression that he'd never heard before, and he just killed it. And it's just like a moment, you know, that I think it's just one of those moments that you recognize as like the person who made the song, where you're like, fuck, that was so crazy, you know? Like, I mean, for everyone else, it sounds like a great sax solo, but like, you know, just knowing that it was kind of first take, but. Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Well, the album is The Madness Hides, and you guys are playing Saturday, I believe.
Wow.
Tomorrow, yes.
Yeah.
And the venue is?
The Rickshaw.
The Rickshaw, great local venue.
Mm-hmm. And we're playing with Freak Heat Waves and Gal Grayson, both incredible bands. Freak Heat Waves from Victoria and Gal Grayson from Vancouver here, so...
Well, come check it out, the data plan tomorrow at the Rickshaw Theater. Malcolm Biddle, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Dan. Cheers, man.
All right, cheers.
Okay, bye. Right.
That was Malcolm Biddle of Data Plan, and be sure to check out their website, dataplan.ca. It's dadaplan.ca, and their new album is The Madness Hides. Before we sign off, we lost two great people in the entertainment world this week. My brother has been a long-time guitar player, and still is. He's in his own band called Kenny and the Jets. And although he was so much older than me, I remember growing up, music was always on whenever he was around. And one of the bands he always used to listen to was Stone Temple Pilots. They were such a great group of guys and had such a unique sound coming out of them. And part of that had to do with their lead singer, Scott Weiland. Of course, Scott died on Thursday, just hours before he was supposed to go on stage in Minnesota. Of course, he didn't just play with Stone Temple Pilots. There's also Velvet Revolver and his new band, The Wildabouts. Like so many rock stars, he battled substance abuse for many years. And ultimately, in the end, it looks like it was just too much to bear. His body couldn't take it anymore. But the thing about music is that even if Scott isn't living, his music still is. So thank you to Scott Weiland for being such an awesome presence in our lives. Speaking of awesome presence, Robert Bob Loggia was one of the finest character actors of our generation. Many may remember him from Big and the iconic scene with Tom Hanks playing chopsticks on the giant piano in the department store. He was also in one of my favorite movies as a kid, Wide Awake, the first film written by M. Night Shyamalan. He was one of those actors that was quite versatile, yet often went unnoticed, although he did receive an Academy Award nomination. He lived to be the ripe old age of 85 and leaves behind a great legacy of work. Bob, we will miss you. Okay, to take us out, we are going to have the data plan with The History of Mirrors. My thanks to Malcolm Biddle, David Sinclair, and Winnie Noah. You can follow me on Twitter at Endeavors Radio. You can follow Leamin on Twitter at Leamin, L-E-A-M-I-N-N. You can follow her on Instagram at Insta_Leamin, or me on Twitter at Endeavors Radio. Follow the company on Twitter at Pods_W_Benefits, or like us on Facebook at Pods with Benefits. You can also visit our website, podswithbenefits.com, where we have links to all our previous shows. Next week, coming up, we have special musical guest, the Kyla Koopman Band, and I'm super, super excited. Our featured guest will be Richard Dawkins. If you like what you hear, please consider hitting the donate button, because that'd be kind of cool of you. All right, this is The Data Plan with A History of Mirrors. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Shift to give yourself a little lift. Just pick a filter and reveal to yourself that being yourself is